So today, the 7th of the 7th, 2017, is 1 year since the Ark Encounter was opened up in the United States. And earlier this year, in May, I was on a speaking tour in the States, and I got an invitation to be a guest of Ken Ham at the Ark Encounter and the Creation Museum. I spent 2 days on their pass as media in order to explore and to evaluate the largest wooden construction of its kind in the world. Noah's Ark at the Ark Encounter is the largest freestanding timber framed structure in the world. 510 feet long, 85 feet wide, and 51 feet high, based on the Bible's dimensions of 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high, using the Hebrew long cubit of 20.4 inches. This very dimension, as you've just seen in the film, Noah Thinking Outside the Box, has convinced engineers and shipbuilders that Genesis must be God's revelation, because that has been, over the centuries, found to be the ideal proportions for an ocean-going vessel. Just an extraordinary dimension right there. Through trial and error, they found out this is just the right proportions to provide a stable vessel in rough seas. 3.1 million board feet of timber were used for the ark structure, and that's not counting the wood in the exhibits. Now, this is the opening day, 7-7 last year. In board feet, that would be 985 kilometers. In other words, the distance between Cape Town and Kimberley, or Cape Town and Bloemfontein, if you prefer. That's a lot of wood. Where did they find the carpenters to build this? Amish craftsmen and carpenters were primarily responsible for the construction of the timber-framed structure. Now, you know who the Amish people are. These are the horse and buggy people. They are, I've just been amongst them. I've been there many a time, just around the Reformation 500 conference in April in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And you actually see signs like this. These people have frozen their technology basically into the 19th century, because they are concerned not to be corrupted by the world, and they're afraid of the distractions of the world. So not only no TV, no radio, and so on, but no electricity. I mean, that's how far they go. No one in the world deals with wood more than the Amish. And in fact, the top engineer and carpenter is a person brought up Amish, who's been handling axes and saws and wood since he was small. He said he was 15 before he first saw a chainsaw. The ark includes 290,000 board feet of timber flooring. So that's 88 kilometers, basically, from Cape Town to Worcester. And that's just the floors. 67,000 holes were drilled into the heavy timber. A total of 300,000 screws were used. 50,000 wooden pegs, bolts and washers and nuts. Now, you know the significance of that, as explained in the film, is that an ocean-going vessel, metal rusts, metal can snap, breaks on, but the wood swells to fit in, and so it's the perfect holding mechanism. And you'll see from how they designed this ark how it's got layers of the hull in order to survive ocean stresses. 95 tons of steel plates and connections were also used. This is an unprecedented achievement. The huge 66 log poles, each of them 16 meters tall, are Douglas fir, Edelman spruce, harvested in Washington and Montana states. And for ecologists deeply concerned, are you not destroying forests? They took these from condemned timber from an area that was going to be cleared anyway, because the trees had died and things like this. So they didn't go into some forest and just harvest timber. They found the most ecologically responsible way of getting this timber. The ark is built on 120 piers, concrete piers, each 15 feet high. The ark's keel is 3.8 meters from the ground, and the roof of the ark is actually 80 feet or 24 meters from the ground. It has a fin that extends even higher on the front, and that's sort of like the wind sail to catch the wind, so make sure it's always facing into the wind, so that you don't get the side rocking, but you rather get the less disturbing front to back rocking. The Ark's 132 exhibit bays house world-class exhibits with fascinating details on geology, history, technology, the world before the flood. I must say, I'm convinced that you can learn more from a day exploring the Ark exhibits or a day exploring the Creation Museum than you can learn an average month in a classroom, and if you think of the average government classroom, probably in a year or so. In fact, I've learned more on science, geography, biology, and all these other parts of education since leaving school than ever learned in school. And I went to a pretty good school. So who was Noah? How could he have built the Ark? How could Noah have learned the skills he needed to build the Ark? Now, they generally tend to depict Noah as some farmer raising chickens and then God calls him to build a ship. It's far more likely that he was a shipbuilder. We know that God gives each person the talents and abilities to accomplish the purpose that he assigns them. And like people today, Noah would have surely developed his God-given abilities throughout his lifetime. And before the flood, people had extraordinarily long lifetimes for several different reasons. The one purpose is that we had a greenhouse effect where there was the waters above and the earth had a very high oxygen content and, of course, complete protection from dangerous UV rays. You didn't have seasons because the earth was straight up on its axis. You had a warm temperate zone around the whole world. You didn't have the harsh changing of seasons. After the flood, the earth shifted 23 degrees off its axis, and we've got these harsh changes between the winter to summer seasons. And therefore, people today don't tend to live over 120 years max, whereas before that, they could live hundreds of years. And imagine how much you could learn in a lifespan of several hundred years. What does the Bible say about Noah? He walked with God. He was a righteous man. He was a preacher of righteousness, and he faithfully followed God's instructions. In fact, Noah almost certainly was a shipbuilder who was familiar with all the building techniques of shipbuilders of his time. He was a family man. At 500 years of age, Noah and his wife had the first of their sons. Talk about waiting. Before long, Shem, Ham, and Japheth had each married a wife. And with so few godly people on the planet, Noah's faithfulness and his righteous ways brought derision and hatred from his neighbors. Genesis 6:13. And God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth." And we read, and Noah did everything that God commanded him. They've got exhibits where this is a talking exhibit. You can actually press one of about 70 odd questions, and Noah answers the questions. And it's an interesting animatronics type of exhibit. And there's one of the questions, "You don't look 600 and something years old." He said, "Well, what's someone 600 odd years meant to look like? I don't look any older than any other 600-year-old man that I know." And then something about his wife, you know, says, "His wife doesn't look a day over 400. And so there's a few interesting comments like this and how he built the Ark and what he used and what the techniques are. And you can see that, of course, they're reading. Of course, you know, did they have reading? Yes, they did. They were literate in the time of the building of the Ark. Of course, they had the wheel. Yes, they had a lot of technology, and he would have had a library. And they've got a whole range of interesting exhibits showing you some of the technology and some of the culture that would have existed before the flood. Noah's three sons doubtless had different skills, including woodworking. Perhaps one son was more the woodworker, another son was more the metal worker. We read that before the flood, Tubal Cain had mastered every type of metalwork and every type of musical instrument. And so that shows there was quite a lot of technology available before the flood. There must have been some amazing technology in the Ark for the Ark to have survived and for us to still be here after global flood. The call comes to Noah, "You shall make an Ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the Ark and cover it with pitch inside and out. Here's how you shall make it. The ark's length shall be 300 cubits. Its width 50 cubits. Its height 30 cubits. Make a window for the ark, finishing it to a cubit from above, and set the door in the ark's side. Build it with the lower, second, and third decks. Behold, I'll bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy all flesh under heaven, in which the breath of life, everything on the earth, shall die. So how could the ark have been built? And from the very beginning, as you're entering, you can see some of the carrying mechanisms, the tools they would have used to carry everything from the pitch on. How did God equip his people to do his work? How did Noah acquire the skills? Well, doubtless he had been a shipbuilder for a large amount of his life. He knew how to build ships, because if he didn't, this ark couldn't have floated, it couldn't have survived, and we wouldn't be here. He, amongst his sons, probably had a diversification of specialties, probably one for agriculture, another for woodwork, another for metalwork, and Noah would have been the designer and coordinator of the whole operation. This is a huge operation. To build a ship this big, you needed to have a phenomenal team and an amazing overseer, and God gave more specific instructions than probably what is recorded here. Now, as you would have seen in the film, Noah's Ark, Think Outside the Box, some people who are skeptical about the Ark's ability to survive looked at 19th century shipbuilding and said it couldn't have survived those dimensions, all wooden ship, in that kind of ocean. True. But you've got ships that were built in the 9th century by the Vikings that were stronger and better than what we were building in the 19th century. You had the Greeks and Phoenicians making far better wooden ships back 20 centuries ago than we had in the 19th century. Why is that? Well, sometimes people lose technology, and sometimes it's not a lack of technology, it's they don't have the patience to do the layers needed. So here they show you the multiple layers that the hull would have had in order to survive the flood, with technology that we know that the Phoenicians had 2,000 years ago, that the Greeks had, and so on, that the Vikings had. And so you can see the interesting utilization of multiple layers and with wooden pegs, which enables it to handle the extra tensions, and you've got fail-safe devices, and also any leaks can be plugged with wooden pegs as well, which swell with water. They've got a model of how Noah's Ark would have operated. So the one extraordinary thing is, with these dimensions, everything fits. So considering they looked at a workable model, which this one's based on, 322,000 gallons of water would have been needed for 12 months worth, of which you could have had 11 months worth held in cisterns, 285,000 gallons in cisterns. Another 95,000 gallons could be in storage vessels. That'd be more than enough. And then there's rain capture. Could have a huge amount of rain capture. Now, you could have fit 447 tractor trailers, containers, into the ark. The ark, here you can see the ark is more than half the length of the Titanic, although it had more floor space, than, although the length wasn't the same. The Statue of Liberty, much longer than the Statue of Liberty is tall, much longer than a Boeing 747, and so on. And so you see the dimensions of it and how much it could actually fit. Now, of the animals, they calculate that 85% of the animals would have weighed less than 10 kilos. 7% of the animals would have weighed, much less, and 8% weighed over about 220 pounds, which is about 100 kilograms. Then they start calculating how many of various things they would need. So you've got, for example, I don't know if you recall when the Two Oceans Aquarium was open at the waterfront, they put up a big billboard which said, "Come see the animals Noah forgot." And although my daughter was only about 9 years old at the time, I remember saying, "That's silly. Noah didn't forget any animals, because sea creatures didn't need to be in the ark." And of course that's true. So you've got all the ocean-going and sea creatures obviously would need to be in the ark, naturally. So that really limits things quite a lot right there. And you can see how they would have divided up the labor. How could 8 people really care for all these thousands of animals on the ark over a year's time period? So they said, okay, division of labor, 1 person dealing with human food and special diets, 3 people cleaning cages, half a person in half a day shoveling waste from pit to pump, 1 person doing the watering, another person doing the feeding, And then 1.5 people, so to speak, are dealing with laundry, human waste removal, maintenance, animal care, miscellaneous, and so on, carpentry. They would need 22 extra large cages, 186 large cages, 293 medium cages, 308 bird cages, 174 small cages, and 415 amphibian cages. So these are the calculations done. They're working on not just the animals that are alive today, but the animals that have gone extinct, but would have been around at that time. Every kind of animal was there, not only in two pairs for the unclean animals, but in seven pairs for the clean animals. And so you've got 14 of many of the animals. So when they said the animals came in two by two, that's true, but sometimes there were seven pairs of one kind of animal. So then they start working out how they could determine numbers of animal kinds, because of course some kinds of animals have developed since then. There is such a thing as evolution within species, but there's no evidence of evolution of species between species. So we know, for example, that a lot of the dogs we see around today would not have been around back then. They have distinctively bred some of the weird types of dogs for hunting, for running, greyhound racing. I mean, there wouldn't have been a greyhound, for example, at that stage, nor a little lap dog, granny's poodle, ankle-biting type dogs. I mean, those were bred over the years specifically. But they recognized that there could have been 300 different kinds of bats. Bats alone on the ark, which is intriguing. As they show that plainly, when it speaks about seven sevens, a male and a female, they're speaking about not seven of that animal, but 14, it's seven pairs. And then not only two of every unclean animal, but there's 14 actually, or seven pairs of every clean animal. They distinguish between them, and they show how it all would have fitted. So this Noah's Ark model is really intricate and detailed, showing the technology, the storage, how they would have operated, where they would have fitted all the animals, and for example, how they would have been able to be removing waste, how they would have been able to be ventilating, cleaning, feeding, providing. And they are calculating that there would have been 1,398 different kinds of animals on the ship, which would have calculated out, looking at clean and unclean, to about 6,744 animals on the ark. And there's space for them all. Now, I don't know who did the proofreading for this. They've got everything from flying creatures, non-mammalian snapsids, the clean mammals, the flightless birds. They've got all the different birds from the gliders, the flightless birds like the ostriches and so on. The different birds that are living, the mammals that are living, the extinct types of reptiles. It's all down there. Can you imagine having a proofreading job for this? All kinds of amphibians, including the ones that are extinct now, and different types of birds, and bats and reptiles. So, key questions. How could they provide enough drinking water? How could they remove animal waste? How could they sustain fresh air? How could they provide sufficient light for eight people and thousands of animals on the ark? Well, for example, you've got rainwater, could have had systems to capture it, and you've got a huge roof area for rain capture, and from those systems fill these means of providing enough water for each of the animals. How they can have through a whole system of gutters on the ark in order to drain, and how could they have ventilated it? Well, for example, one of the methods that they're talking about is a moon, what do we call it? It's a column within the ship where the water inside this column would not rise higher than the water outside, of course. So you have it high enough, and that's through wave motion. So possible air refreshing techniques could be the moon pool concept with a wave-powered purifier. They've got, for example, moon pools. I've just seen when I examined the Agulhas craft just a week and a half ago, our SA Agulhas 2 in the harbour, how they've got this moon pool. And ancient vessels were known to use this too, that you can have a moon pool within the vessel, and it's not a danger because the water will not rise higher than the outside level just because of gravity. And a moon pool is an extremely effective mechanism to provide a continual supply of fresh air, because Each falling wave inside the moon pool pulls in fresh air, and each rising wave pushes the fresh air through the shaft, and they can channel it through to the bottom deck, which is the most efficient, by a piping system. And the fresh air can be directed to the lowest level to bring fresh air to each of the decks. So that moon pool would be an extremely effective way using wave power in order to provide adequate kinds of fresh air throughout the shaft. So this is basically a well inside the arc. And this model that they've built incorporates a moon pool. Falling waves pull in the fresh air. And so you can imagine how effective that would be. The arc could have included a variety of other ingenious methods to circulate air. You could have had a furnace fueling by animal waste, which could have been used to heat air and create a draft system in a specially constructed flute and chimney system. Another possibility is you could have had mechanically powered bellows or fans that could be built to blow air through the arc. Animals on treadmills, for example. Many modern buildings that house large numbers of animals don't need any form of mechanics for ventilation. Instead, they're relying on a natural convection current to circulate air. And sufficient airflow could have been produced by the temperature difference between cool surface of the arc, the body heat by warm-blooded animals. How could the arc have been lit? Well, as we read, that he is to finish the arc to within a cubit of the roof, and then there was an opening or windows on the top. And so you could see how that mechanism could provide natural light during daylight hours. The Lord in Genesis 6:16 instructed Noah, finish the roof to a cubit from the top. And this is effectively a window type idea of having a shutter. So light could have been spilled through this opening throughout the ark. Genesis 8:13 states that Noah removed the ark's covering as the earth dried near the time of the end of the Taman ark. And the covering could have referred to something other than the window. And this covering, he released the bird through and the bird came back. So this could have been a section roof that could be drawn back to serve as a central skylight. So you've got your air shafts, your moon pools, the wells, cisterns, and you've got a wave-powered purifier, which is good, easy technology. They could have also supplemented their lighting with artificial lighting, oil lamps, candles, sunlight through opening, sunlight through covering. These are some of the options. They could have had an oil lamp, they could have had open flame sources, candles or torches. But the lighting is intriguing. Looking at how the way that the ark has been constructed, you could see the central system can provide both light and fresh air. And this is how they built it. It's really impressive to see this massive structure, and you can see how the lighting is very effective from the skylights that they've organized right down the center of the arc, and this impressive wood. Notice all the flooring is bamboo flooring. These are some of these massive spruces that they harvested to provide central timber holding the whole central structure together. So how could the ark have provided sufficient food for the thousands of species? How could they have stored sufficient food, provided it? Of course, there's a lot of ingenious ways of having enough food and space and storage, and they have calculated all this in, providing enough for water, oil, all kinds of vessels that they may need, and almost certainly had catwalks, where the most efficient way to have fed all this large number of animals would be catwalks above. It's a safe way. They could have used an automated process to handle many of the responsibilities related to animal care. Food and water systems could have been used to contain several days' worth of nourishment, allowing animals to eat whenever they wanted, so they didn't have to necessarily feed them every single day. And, for example, water distribution, you could have the cisterns channeling into water containers that, again, are using a gravity system to provide just enough water as an animal needs, and similarly with the refillable feeders. And this can provide quite a lot of food, an easy way of channeling it from the catwalk above to animals below, and they have got here their feeders and their water containers for regular supply. This would not take too long for one or two people to be able to walk up and down the catwalks and ensure that all animals have a fair and equal distribution of what they need according to their sizes. And these are examples of some of the smart feeders and supplies that are provided: water, food. Now, how could Noah's family tend thousands of animals? Well, you need workable models and you need manageable workloads. When God commanded Noah to bring representatives of every land-dependent creature on the ark, providing for this diversity of creatures would have involved a lot of work. Some people have said, well, maybe many animals were put into hibernation. It's possible. But even if not, they've got less activity, and so they wouldn't need as much as well. Plus, it's a climate-controlled environment, so it's not in as harsh a situation. About 850 animals per person, considering there's 8 people in the ark. This is manageable. Storage vessels, smart feeders for small creatures. And what about reptiles and amphibians? Well, they've got a whole way of, this is where they keep some of the reptiles and amphibians. Half cut out showing you how you could have, on the one side, a whole lot of moths and so on multiplying, and some would feed through, providing enough for example your chameleons to feed on, having a channeling system like this. Food containers for some of the little creatures, food vessels. Again, many of these creatures you don't need to be refilling their feeders every day, it could be every week or so, in quite a few of the cases, especially the small animals. What about the picky eaters? Their specialized diets, vampire bats, koalas, anteaters. Well, yes, anteaters can devour up to 35,000 insects a day, but in captivity you can feed anteaters on fruit and eggs. In the wild, they also consume fruit that's fallen from the ground. Other anteaters can climb trees to get food, so it doesn't have to be providing them with ants. Koalas do prefer eucalyptics, yes, but they can eat other kind of leaves, and they could have easily been fed on grains, fruits, and vegetables. Even if they preferred eucalyptus, if you didn't have a good supply, alternatives would work. Now, how could the ark provide sufficient water for thousands of species? Well, just take rainwater, there wouldn't be no shortage, and just an inch of rainwater would provide enough water for the whole ark in a given day. You've got cisterns refilling some of these smart water replenishers. So you could have funneled to large strategically placed storage systems, a number of spigots and bamboo, maybe even copper pipes could have delivered water throughout the ark. And just 1 inch of rainfall a week would have kept all the cisterns full. Which, let's face it, that's quite enough. And this system is workable. The small animals, okay, how do you, for example, handle removal of droppings? Slotted floors in the cages by having it over bamboo type, where there's spaces between, by sheer gravity with angled trays placed beneath them, would move the waste of many animals to collection trays at the bottom of the stack that could be easily cleaned. Something like this, where you've got a mechanism to easily channel it out, and then they can either using wheelbarrows, or it could go channeling all the way through, can be dropping into the moon pools specifically designed for removal of waste. They can have elephants or anything else, readily treading ox even, a treadmill, which can make this quite feasible to be able to remove both channeling urine out, channeling out solid waste. It's feasible. Then they're talking about the 8 people on the ark, and why are their living quarters so nice? And they said, well, while they are obviously using some kind of artistic license, because they knew they were going to be on the ark for a long time, they probably moved the homes and are probably living on the ark for the last many years of it being built. I mean, why not? Why travel to your workplace if you can build a nice quarters on board? And these people were very advanced. Bear in mind that the modern concept that the people in the past were knuckle-dragging Neanderthals, dragging a wife by the hair and carrying a club, is doubtless inaccurate. People were advanced, they were literate, they had musical instruments, they would have had a variety of cooking styles, and their diet would have been very varied, and we've got all the evidence of that. So they're depicting the way life would have been like and what their kitchens may have been like on the Ark, the kind of ovens they could have used, and the kind of vegetable gardens that would have been growing even on the Ark. And so this is just some of the exhibits you get on there to have an understanding of the kind of tools they used, the kind of cooking instruments, the kind of plates, board, pottery, and so on, and the styles of living. Hammocks would have been quite popular on a ship because you can rock with it, and doubtless a lot of strategic planning, so scrolls, books, baskets. This helps one to get a much better idea. The idea of it being just some kind of berth or bunkers, not realistic considering how many years they had to prepare and the fact that they knew how long they would be there. You can see again artistic styles and skills. These are the ancestors of all living, and therefore you can imagine a lot of the talents that we see around today would have been in seed form over there. Weaving, sleeping quarters, the different art, catching birds on the ship, and the different types of bird cages. There's also comparisons with other flood narratives in different cultures around the world. Post-flood world, Babel, evidence for the worldwide flood, and a whole lot more is in the Ark. For example, do you know that there's over 200 different legends of the Ark around the world? In fact, every part of the world has some kind of flood legends. Now, critics of the Bible often claim that the biblical flood account must have been copied from the ancient Babylonian or Sumerian legends, since these writings predate the time of Moses. But it makes much more sense to believe the biblical account reveals the true history of the flood, while legends give a distorted version of the same event. So you can see this is all around. You've got certain details like a favored family who built a huge boat and, along with some animals, survived a worldwide catastrophe sent by an angry deity. That's a commonality that you get all over the world, every continent, in at least 200 different varieties, from the Aztecs and the Mayans and the Incas and the Arawaks and the Montagnes and the Norse, the Vikings, the Greeks, the Aztec, the Mitsu, Rukwa, Maasais, the Hawaiians, Fiji. They've got all kinds. Some, like the Vanuatu tale, is of a large canoe, 50 feet by 10 feet. Well, of course, you don't have any tree large enough to hold all the people and animals, and a canoe would quickly be swamped by a flood. But while not all of these are very believable, they all have a commonality. Interesting, the idea of a big box. That wouldn't be very comfortable. And they've got a big circular tablet, in this case, a large coracle. And these different varieties around the world all show there was something. There was some flood, although some of their legends are a bit unbelievable, like how are you going to find a raft that's strong enough to not break apart and big enough for all the animals and for them to not slip off in the turbulent sea. But still, the Epic of Gilgamesh is intriguing, being this hulking great big box, which is the favored view in the Arabian area, for example. But the Bible has got a dimension that clearly has the shipbuilding capability to survive a flood. It's big enough to accommodate all the animals, people, and supplies. The dimensions are ideal for strength, stability, and even comfort. So, you've got 200 legends around the world, and since the Bible is God's word and is accurate in all that records, this accuracy isn't just limited to matters of faith, but any subject, even history. Now, only the dimensions of the biblical ark, as found in Genesis, provides the ideal strength, size, stability, and comfort for a ship built to protect the people and the animals during a flood. So, for example, they've got a film which we could show a bit later on, which, sink or swim, which ark can survive a global flood? Now, in Cape Town, we have had some storms, and even when it's not that stormy, you can see the power of the sea. Imagine being in a wooden vessel in the middle of a worldwide stormy flood. Oceans deep, broken up. So you look at the different canoes and rafts, no survivors. are possible. None of them are strong enough, none of them are big enough, none of them have the requirements to survive. Only the Bible tells of an ark, the size and proportions that can survive and protect its passengers from destruction in a year-long flood. Genesis 8, verse 18 to 19 says, Noah and his family, along with all the animals, went out of the ark at the end. They all survived the flood. So, there's a lot of interesting exhibits, including showing what could have been the ancestors of all the foxes and wolves that we see in the world today, or all the different types of gorillas, orangutans, chimpanzees, and so on. You wouldn't have necessarily had every type of cat on board, because we've seen how cats have evolved over the time. There's an interesting exhibit on the fairy tale ark, and there's exhibits where you can ask questions of these automated models that give you interesting responses. There's the Rainbow Covenant, some beautiful artwork, some magnificent views. But bear in mind, the animals that Noah forgot, as they've liked to said, there's a huge amount of sea creatures that, of course, did not need an ark and had survived outside the ark in the middle of the flood. And some magnificent sea creatures, like the great whales. And these creatures were, of course, outside the ark. And that's, in fact, most of the creatures in the world are ocean creatures. The catastrophe of the flood is critical to understanding our world. Ken Ham has said that his interest in the ark and the flood was intensified when he read The Genesis Flood by Henry Morris and John Whitcomb. The catastrophic event of the flood explains most of the fossil record and is integral to a full understanding on the topic of our origins. Take, for example, which planet suffered a major catastrophic flood? The Earth, which is 70% water, or Mars, which doesn't have a drop of water? Interestingly enough, despite the fact that there's no known liquid water on the surface of Mars, many scientists believe Mars once suffered a flood of biblical proportions, covering the whole planet. Now, ironically, these are the same scientists who deny that the Earth, a planet 70% covered by water, ever had a global flood. Intriguing. And what you've got right now is something stranger than fiction. Many will deny the biblical flood without any scientific basis. It's more like a bias. Look at some of the evidence for a flood on Mars. You've got these huge, obviously, water features, channels. I mean, this is evidence on the surface of Mars that there must have been a lot of water at some stage. And so scientists look at pictures like this from Mars and say, this is evidence of a flood on Mars. But there's no water on Mars. So here's the Viking orbiters back in the 1970s discovering what seemed to be dried out riverbeds with branching drainage patterns. And that's intriguing. They, in 2012, even found rounded gravel similar to those found in Earth's stream beds. The gravel's too large to be transported and rounded by wind. It must have been rounded by water. So, when you see the same evidence for massive flooding on Mars, you can find an abundance on Earth. The Earth carries all the hallmarks of a planet that once had a global flood. And the flood described in Genesis would lay down the vast majority of the Earth's fossil-bearing rock layers in short periods of time. Billions of organisms were buried in the process, explaining the fossil record. The remains of these fossilized creatures and the sedimentary layers in which they found bear witness to this event. So why do so many scientists reject a massive flood on Earth while accepting a massive flood on Mars? I mean, just look. Here you can see in the desert in Israel. Is this not evidence of a flood? Because it's in the desert, but there's, I mean, obviously features that could have only been formed by massive quantities of water. You've got in Arizona, interesting, all these rounded rocks, which is in a desert again, but nobody doubts that that was formed by water, you would think. Well, when they see the same features on Mars, they say, must have been a flood. You see it on Earth, they say, no, it couldn't have been a flood. And here in Egypt, I mean, does this not look in the desert of Egypt like there was a lot of water there? So why do so many scientists reject a massive flood on Earth while accepting one on Mars? The truth is that the worldwide flood described in Genesis would completely undermine evolutionary beliefs about life on this planet. The rejection of the biblical flood is often due to evolutionary bias, not actual evidence or investigation. In fact, it's not a stretch to imagine that nearly every geologist would appeal to a global flood to explain many of the Earth's features if the Bible had never mentioned a global flood. The only reason they reject a flood on Earth is because the Bible says so. All the evidence points to it. And that is a telling indictment on many. So, just imagine the flood. The Bible speaks about the fountains of the deep being opened up and the water above coming down and the waters from below. And this would have been fissures widening in the Earth's crust, coming to contact with seawater, creating massive jet streams. And these jet streams would have shot through the ocean, the upper atmosphere, generating intensely heavy global rainfall for the next 40 days and 40 nights. The water levels would have risen globally. Tsunamis would have battered the fragments of Earth's original supercontinent. There's evidence we once had one continent, and all the different continents were broken up afterwards. And the land would have been rapidly eroded, and large amounts of sediment would have been carried away. Land animals that survived the early stages of this advancing catastrophe would have progressively been buried in the rapidly accumulating layers of sediments on the submerged land masses, which would eventually lead to their fossilization. The entire Earth would be underwater as all life on Earth would be wiped out. Waters would dominate the Earth, and the flood waters covered the entire Earth and dominated for 150 days. The highest hills were covered by water to a depth of at least 15 cubits, more than 25 feet. And then the relatively swift-moving continental fragments or plates would collide underwater, forcing up mountain ranges. For example, the Himalayas, the largest mountain range in the world, would have been as India, which looks like it came from parts of Africa, moved over, and then as they collided, you would have had these massive new mountains forming. So when people say, are you telling me that the flood was higher than Mount Everest? Well, Mount Everest wouldn't have been there when the flood began. It would have been a result of the tectonic shifting that would have taken place during the global flood. You doubtless didn't have mountains anywhere near as high then as you had after the flood. On the 17th day of the 7th month of Noah's 600th year, the ark came to rest on one of the newly formed mountains in the region of Ararat. On the first day of the 10th month of Noah's 600th year, the tops of the other mountains rose above the water surface as the waters were also draining away. As land masses continued to rise and the waters continued to run off the merging land surfaces, large amounts of sediment would be washed away and canyons would quickly be formed into the rock layer. So Blind River Canyon, Fish River Canyon, Grand Canyon would have been formed at that time of the flood, at the end of the flood. And then in Noah's 601st year, on the 27th day of the second month, the ground is dry enough for land creatures to live on. And thus, approximately 1 year after boarding, Noah and his family and all the animals would have been able to leave the ark. And this would have been a new world. We've got books here from Institute of Creation Research speaking about the world that perished. And it's important to realize that we're not living on the world that God created. The world that God created was a perfect paradise. And that was destroyed in the flood. There's still some beauty on this earth, but there's a lot of harshness that wasn't there in the original earth. The original earth was a paradise in the temperate zone with high levels of oxygen. You could have run all day and not been exhausted with the levels of oxygen, air, and the fitness and health of Adam and Eve. We are a shadow of the fitness and even intellectual capacity that Adam and Eve and their immediate descendants would have had, because there's been a deterioration because of sin over the years. But the world, and a lot of the harshness in the world, is a result of the flood. The original world God created was destroyed in the flood. What we're living in is a different world, much scarred by the results of the flood, of that catastrophe. Now, the wicked pre-flood world, supercontinent, was destroyed, and a new world with seven continents rose from the waters. And they were covered with layers of fossil-filled sediment deposited by water, testifying of the biblical account in Genesis. Noah's family was then given an opportunity to start over, to be fruitful, to multiply, and to fill the earth. So how do we interpret the evidence? Creationists and evolutionists are studying the same evidence. We're looking at the same rocks, the same fossils, and the same world. So why do we reach different conclusions about the same evidence? Our conclusions are strongly influenced by our worldviews. For example, the evolutionary worldview looks at the rock layers around the world and says, oh, this is the result of slow and gradual progress processes over the course of millions and millions of years. But people from a biblical worldview look at the same rock layers and see overwhelming evidence that they were rapidly laid down during the year-long global flood as described in Genesis. So we've got one world, but we've got two views. The biblical creation model says life came from life, personally crafted by the uncreated God of the Bible. The naturalistic or evolutionary model says life spontaneously came from non-life. Life is an unintended natural phenomenon, from goo to the zoo to you, from mud to molecules to man, to monkeys to man. And once upon a time there was nothing, and then there was something, and something became everything. A big explosion just created order, like throw a bomb into a printing press and you'll get a dictionary. Throw a bomb into a junkyard and you can get a Boeing 747 jet, tanked up runway there, pilot in, fuel, all that, seatbelts, the whole lot. Somehow order comes out of chaos. Not that we see that in science, in observable science. The biblical model says animals were created as distinct kinds about 6,000 years ago, but the evolutionists said all animals have descended from a common ancestor, some kind of ooze that came out of the slime, at least 3.5 billion years ago. We see changes within kinds as a result of design features, but they see changes that animals undergo as purely unintended natural phenomena. For example, a giraffe's got a long neck because he had to stretch his neck to reach the food he liked. Then why do the female giraffes all have shorter necks than the males? I mean, how do they survive? And how do you survive when the food's just out of reach each time? But the giraffe puts his head down to drink and he doesn't pass out from this phenomenal amount of blood that's rushing down the neck, because there's a mechanism in the neck to catch the blood and to stop him passing out the moment he puts his neck all the way down. I mean, sometimes we can reach down in a moment and suddenly feel dizzy, and we're nothing like a giraffe. But they've got, now how did they get these features? How did the cheetah get the phenomenal ability to run as so fast in such a short space time? They've got the most amazing, they've designed intelligently for speed. But they want to suggest, no, this was just a cat who somehow need to run faster. And over millions and billions of years. So we don't see any new animal kinds developing, and we don't see animals changing into totally different kinds. But the evolutionist believes that they can change into completely different animals. I mean, there's even the term, is it in Afrikaans for a hippopotamus being a sea koi? A sea cow. Well, there are people who believe that a cow is just a whale who wandered onto land and developed feet. And there are people who say you can go up in Table Mountain, they've got some evolutionary statements that the dassie is the closest living relative to the elephant. You think, is this a joke? Are there intelligent people in the world who believe that dassie is related to the elephant? But unreal. I've said this to some evolutionists. No, but it's true. Oh my. Sigh. So, we believe death is an unnatural enemy introduced by Adam and removed by Christ. But the evolutionist says, no, death like life is a meaningless chemical phenomenon. You came from nothing, you're going nowhere, life is meaningless. Now, evolutionary shortcomings include they teaching life comes from non-life. Naturalistic forms have fatal flaws. How do they explain the origin of life? I mean, you can say, where did man come from? From monkeys. Where did monkeys come from? Well, from molecules. Where did the molecules come from? Well, some explosion. Where'd that come from? Aliens from another planet? I mean, they really have a problem with origins. Where did it all begin? And the idea that life spontaneously came out of non-life through chance chemical reactions has never been observed in nature or replicated in the laboratory, even with all of our intelligent attempts to try to replicate it. We can't. And if we ever did, it would show that a lot of intelligence made it, not that it happened spontaneously. Even if scientists one day could create life in a laboratory, it would only demonstrate that the creation of life requires great intelligence. The law of biogenesis explains that life can only come from living organisms. Is there anyone out there? To avoid the impossibility of life forming from non-life, some individuals, including some prominent scientists, promote the idea of what they call panspermia, that life on Earth had its origins elsewhere in the universe. This alien proposed pass the buck on the original problem also has a problem, because if life could not evolve from non-life on Earth, a plant perfectly suited for life, how should we assume that life couldn't evolve from non-life in another plant? And so far I haven't found any other plant in the universe that is conducive to life like Earth is. Other places don't have oxygen. Now, you know, Star Wars might be able to speak about a planet far, far away, but that's actually fiction. That may distress some people, but we don't know of any evidence of another planet which can sustain life yet. And we're living in a material world, and a huge problem for naturalistic thinking is its foundation in materialism, that only matter exists. However, morality and laws of logic and laws of nature are all non-physical. You can swing by a grocery store, you can buy 2 ounces of logic, a bag of natural law, a carton of morality? No. In a universe without laws or logic or laws of nature, how could you prove that the naturalist evolution has occurred? How can anyone know anything if your thoughts are merely chemical reactions? How can logic grow out of chance? So, if the evolutionist is right that you came from nowhere, you're going nowhere, and life is meaningless, where does logic even come in? If these are just chance chemical reactions in our brains, how can we prove anything logically? Some people attempt to combine aspects of biblical creation with evolution. This idea contradicts the Bible at many points, including the Bible makes it clear death entered the world when Adam and Eve sinned. Thorns and thistles originated with a curse. Men and women were created at the beginning of history. But if you ask an evolutionist, what came first? What evolved first? A man or a woman? Well, as it happens, women are more complicated and couldn't have occurred first according to their idea. Well, if there's millions of years between the first man and the first woman, I mean, you've got a few problems. Then you've got all sorts of other complications, just like the chameleon. And they've got the ability to shoot out their tongue 5 times faster than the acceleration of a fighter jet. They've got a suction cap at the end. Which came first? There's no point having the ability to shoot out your tongue, which is 2.5 times the length of the body, at this kind of speed if you don't have a suction cap at the other end in order to bring this insect back in. What evolved first? There's so many different aspects you can think of any type of animal. So with the complexity that we've got in a whole lot of creation, and yet you could even have someone like Charles Darwin say, I freely confess that to suggest that the human eye evolved seems foolishness in the extreme. And the human eye is nothing compared to the eagle's eye. They can see 12 to 20 times better than we can. And so to suggest the human eye evolved is insane, and yet you've got all kinds of eyes in the world that's even better than that. Now, burial during millions of years requires uniformitarianism, and they've got a very nice list of all the different fossils that have been laid down over the years. But there's a problem. Where are all the transitional fossils? Why are the time gaps between, with no erosion between, some of the layers of columns? And due to the repeated churning of soil by tiny organisms, a process known as bioturbation, gradual process of depositing sediments would not permit distinct rock layers to form. And so this burial during millions of years doesn't seem to work. What we do see in observable science is not the pattern they teach in the school textbooks, because they can't find anywhere in the world where they get that pattern, which they have said this is the way it's got to be. But these are the fossils that we see, and you can immediately see that, for example, you've got fossils spreading across what's meant to be millions of years of a single animal or a single tree. And how do they explain this? Here, across several layers, this is meant to represent millions of years, you've got one creature, one reptile. A creation model explains most of the fossil-bearing rock layers were deposited during a worldwide flood. And the order in which fossils appear in the record can be gradually understood by a process of burial according to the ecosystems in which the creatures lived in a pre-flood world. Although marine fossils are found throughout this record, and you can find marine fossils on top of Table Mountain. And so you can see the order of burial is as the waters rose during the flood. And then you've also got mother and baby buried together in fossil form. That can't happen over millions of years. It happens very, very quickly. And so we see sediment layers deposit across the continents, and we see rock layers, which prove to us that, in fact, what they're saying, well, this happened at this and that, it doesn't fit. Nowhere in nature can you see observable rock layers that fit the evolutionary model. But we do see rock layers fitting the flood model. Millions of years of alleged time are missing from the Grand Canyon, for example, or Fish River Canyon or Blood River Canyon. And this is what they call paraconformities. This is a technical term given the contact point between two rock layers where there's no evidence of erosion, representing what is meant to be millions of years between them. This is a problem. And the evolutionists need to explain why it is that what we observe is not the same as what they've got in their textbooks. And so a lot of these millions of years things are challenged, and millions of years pass between these layers being laid down. Why are the erosion features not present? And again, they can see rock layer sequences deposit rapidly before being bent. And there's a whole lot of examples of how something like the Fish River Canyon in South Africa, or Blood River Canyon, or the Grand Canyon in America formed. The biblical position is that God creates a perfect world, and he creates man, and he calls man and the creation good, but man's sin corrupts creation, brings death, suffering, and disease. Flood waters cover the whole earth. That's the biblical position. But the old earth position, what you call theistic evolution, God created using evolution, means billions of things died before the first man evolved or came about. So man's sin has virtually no effect on creation because there's already been death and thorns for millions of years before man sinned. And it was a local flood. Well, if it was a local flood, why build an ark? Why not just move out of the area? It's a lot easier than building this highly difficult, huge boat. Then you've got all kinds of things like, an upright tree buried across many layers, which is meant to represent millions of years. Serious problem. You've got all kinds of things that should not be if you were dealing with the science so-called that the evolutionists are trying to communicate to us. So according to the predominant scientific model, the layers of the geological column represent hundreds of millions of years of slow and gradual geological processes. And this allegedly is meant to show that simple organisms could progressively develop into complex life forms over long periods of time. You just can't see the evidence of it. And the same thing with the marine fossils. So they say that a fossil takes a long period of time to form. But in fact, fossils can only form very quickly. It's formed as minerals in the ground replace the bones and other materials of the creature. Unless they're buried rapidly and preserved, it'll decompose over time and you wouldn't have a fossil. So these fossils all come from the flood, basically. Oh, you can also deal with climate change. They've got a whole lot there dealing with sunspot activity, greenhouse gases, volcanoes. In fact, a volcano produces more global warming than all human sources combined, just one. And so we've had times like the medieval warm period, which had far warmer climate than we've had now. You've had the little ice age between the 1400s and the 1800s, which it was, you were ice skating on the Thames River in England at one stage. Just in the 1600s. So, global warming gets dealt with. Why don't changes within kinds support evolution? Because changes within kinds are observable, changes between kinds are not observable. So when we talk about the flood, we're talking about a flood that would have involved probably tsunami-type conditions all over the world, and you would have seen a tremendous amount of water shot up into the sky, and great fissures from these breaks in the Earth's crust, a large amount of water going high into the sky, and you can imagine coming down like ice. You've got hot water going up rapidly, being turned to ice, coming crashing down again. And so, biblically, they believe there was only one ice age, one major ice age, and that was as a direct result of the flood. And there's a whole lot of details on this and how far the ice age would have reached, and you can see evidence of it would have gone pretty far down. During the ice age, you had some of these giants like mammoths developing. It would have been a very harsh life immediately after the flood, as you've gone through this beautiful warm temperate zone with only one season in the year to suddenly four seasons, as the earth tilted now 23 degrees, and everything would have been a lot harsher. And during that time, when there was a huge amount of ice age, you would have had these land bridges where animals could have and people could have passed between, for example, Asia and Americas and to Australasia and so on, which would explain why you've got some areas where you'd think, well, how did people get from the Ark? As some have said, how did the kangaroo get from the Ark to Australia? And the answer is by hopping. And there would have been all kinds of means by natural bridges, even debris, sometimes floating, that some people might have reached some of the more strange islands. And that's why you can have some parts of the world where there's not much of a predator, some of the islands in the Pacific and so on. None got there, and that's why you've got some huge amounts of birds. For example, Marion Island, which Shalaf controls, had no predators and huge bird sanctuary until people brought cats on the island, and next thing you knew, there were too many cats, and they'd upset the ecosystem of what was there. And then evidences of the Ice Age. You can imagine how you would have had the glaciers taking rocks and soil and depositing them far further away than they would have existed. And that's where you get the glacial erratic. Some rock or boulder differing in mineral content from the surrounding rocks suddenly resting in a strange area. And so you can see where the glaciers came and then when they retreated. And this explains a lot of the flattened areas, leaving some boulders behind and so on. And we see evidence of the flood even on top of Table Mountain. Anyway, this is all perfectly consistent with the global flood described in Genesis. Here's an interesting example. The Lost Squadron. 1942, six P-38 fighter planes and two B-17 bombers were forced to land on the ice of Greenland. The planes were abandoned, practically forgotten. Nearly 40 years later, search was made, and they came to try and find the evidence of this lost squadron, which had crashed, landed on the ice. And they found them deep, deep, deep under the ice, under 250 feet beneath the surface, which evolutionists would say, oh, yeah, that represents millions of years. Well, this happened in 40 years. And so in 1992, an expedition bored a hole into ice, retrieved the planes bit by bit. One plane, Glacier Bird, actually was restored and flown again in 2002. Now, the fact that these aircraft were buried under more than 250 feet of snow and ice in less than 50 years reveals the unreliability of using the so-called annual layers as a dating method. They aren't annual layers. Sometimes they're from one snowstorm to another, which could be multiple in a single year. And the borehole went through far more than 50 layers. In fact, it would have been what others would have called millions of years of ice that they dug through. But it wasn't. It was just 40 years. Imagine, and they retrieved these planes and brought them up. Very determined people. Interesting exercise, and certainly something that blows a hole in the whole idea of the evolutionists. Same with the global climate change ideas. There's been huge amounts of changes. We are by no means upon the hottest times of year. We've had much warmer times in the Middle Ages than we have right now. So, the Creation Museum, which opened 10 years ago in 2007, has a spectacular Noah's Ark exhibit, which has become very popular for museum visitors. But this massive exhibit doesn't even represent 1% of the Ark's volume. So in 2004, the leadership team at Arts and Genesis began to put together a strategic plan to build a life-sized Noah's Ark after the Creation Museum's completion. And from the very beginning, Ken Hammond visited the museum highlighting the seven C's: creation, corruption, catastrophe, confusion, Christ, cross, consummation. And we'll look at that next week in more depth under the Creation Museum and looking at their great exhibits there. But these are the seven seas and God's eternal plan. Inspired by Colossians 3 verse 23, whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men. Aunts and Genesis believe that their museum and their exhibits must be as good as or better than what the secular world offers, and it is. We have the greatest and most important message in the universe to proclaim the gospel. And just a few of the exhibits in the Creation Museum, which we'll look at more next week. So Ken Ham explained to us that the Ark Encounter consists of exhibits within an exhibit. So the massive Ark is an exhibit. And inside the wooden structure are 132 exhibits containing stunning teaching. The Ark is the biggest of its kind in the world. It's a jaw-dropping experience. God created wood, and there's something about wood, especially the enormous amount of wood seen inside the Ark, that absolutely fascinates people. They love the look and the feel of it. Guests often stop and contemplate the massive themes and the craftsmanship that went into building of the Ark structure. And then guests often also notice the complexity of the Ark's engineering and architecture. And this gives them an opportunity to get them to think about Noah and his brilliance in the correct way. We'll get to that after tea time, some of the excellence in engineering and the technology of the time. Because many people think of ancient man and more brutes than brilliant. But in fact, as you'll see, a lot of technology that they had in the past that we're not even sure how they did it today.